I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The state legislature's reached the halfway point of their session. What have they accomplished so far, and what's left to come? I'll talk with 90.7 political commentators Democrat Dick Batchelor and Republican Lou Fry for their take on the 2013 legislative session and other issues in national, state and local politics. Also, the Florida Film Festival is underway, screening the works of independent filmmakers from across the country. I'll talk to one of the directors about the filmmaking process and Florida's place in the independent film scene. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Dick Batchelor, a former Democrat State House representative and head of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Dick, nice to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for having us.
Joining us also is Lou Fry, former Republican congressman and an attorney at Lowndes, Drostick, Doster, Cantor and Reed. Lou, good to see you again too.
Back from Annapolis. I'm ready to go. Go Navy.
So let's talk about what's happening in the state legislature. We're just past the halfway point now, and both chambers have agreed on a $74 billion spending plan. Is this the budget you expected to see with the first surplus in years?
I would think so. I mean, $74 billion is a lot of money. However, they have money for the first time. You know, they both are going to keep the rainy day fund, as they call it. You know, one's about $1.5 billion more than the other for the rainy day fund, which is a reserve fund. But they have money for the first time. We've been in a recession, and now they've got money. They're actually funding things that heretofore they weren't able to. They're talking about a pay raise for teachers, a pay raise for state employees, putting $300 million back into higher education, putting $1 billion back in K through 12. Lou can tell you, as a former member of Congress, it's a lot more fun when you have money.
Oh, yeah. You're everybody's friend. Everybody's your friend. You can go around and smile at everybody and no pressure there. But, you know, really, Dick, when you look at the budget, time-wise, we're probably halfway there. In time of what we've accomplished, we're probably about 10% there. The hard choices have yet to come.
Good point.
What do you see as the toughest choices that this legislature will have to face up to then?
How about health care?
Yeah. Medicaid expansion.
Yeah. And the impact of the governor, what the governor is going to do or not do, what the Republican Party is going to do or not do. What happens if the money doesn't come? Where do we go for that? Does it throw this budget out the window? So we're really just at that transition point. We've got a lot of, not much time left and a lot to do.
Chime in on that, too. You've got, you know, what are they going to do about PIP, you know, no-fault insurance? You know, what are they going to do about, the budget has to still be reconciled between the House and the Senate. They are a couple of billion dollars apart anyway. And these priorities. But I get back to Lou's point and agree, Medicaid expansion, whether or not you call it Medicare, Obamacare, whatever you decide to call it, you know, the House and Senate differ on that, but both have said no to Obamacare. But they are talking about maybe using the Medicaid expansion dollars to pay insurance premiums in the private market as a way to get around Obamacare. There's some discussion, but I was even Senator Gates, the Senate president, says, look, we can't leave without doing something. So the last point I'll make is that might also mean a special session. If it's too complicated with all the other things.
You mean just on the health care issue,
just
right?
On the health care issue. They have to tackle it one way or the other. You know, if you're going to do Medicaid expansion, keep in mind that the Supreme Court decision, you know, said the states did not have to expand Medicaid. It's each state's option. But in the state of Florida, if you expand it, you could cover almost 1 million new people who today do not have health care coverage. And the thing, almost a special session would be my preference, because you can take a deep breath, back up, and look at a very complicated thing, set this budget aside, all these other issues they're dealing with, and maybe get a focus on it. I think you can get a decision in a special session.
Plus, there's a lot of work that's been done, not just in this session before. There's a lot of these plans that have been thrown up in the air, in and out, and so forth. So I don't think you'd necessarily be standing behind. The facts are there. The question is what you're going to do with them. And maybe in a special session, you're better off to deal with them because you can't get hurt that long politically. It's in and out.
Lou Fry, is that what you see happening? Do you think a special session is likely to be the outcome of this if they can't sort of make some decision on what's going
on?
Well,
unless something happens in the next week or so, I think it's inevitable. I don't know what else you're going to be able to do.
Well, let me ask you too, Lou Fry, the fact that Governor Rick Scott, as we were discussing last time, was supporting the Medicaid expansion is a bit of an about-face, and the Republicans in the legislature are against that. I mean, what do you think this kind of standoff says about the governor's relationship with lawmakers?
Well, I think more important, what it says about the governor's relationship with the voter is that he's willing to step out for the voter despite the Republican Party. He's in a wonderful position now. He's fighting to help people and so forth. And, you know, and there he is out there leading the charge and so forth. And the Republicans are back saying, hey, wait a minute. Aren't you the fellow who ran your campaign against it? But it's a good buyout for him. It's a nice way to get not to be just a Republican on every issue. And I think that's what he's done. He's isolated himself from some of the Republican issues. And I think it's a plus because I think the people in the middle like it. And that's where the election's going to be won or lost.
And it's political to the extent, too. As you know, traditionally, the Democrats have to run to the left to win the nomination in the Democratic primary. The Republicans run to the right to win the nomination in the Republican primary. Then you try to get back to the middle as soon as you can before the general electorate. Now, what the governor has taken and his risk is he's taken the risk that he will not have a Republican opponent. At least he will not have a strong Republican opponent. So now he can start moving to the middle, mm-hmm. changing his mind on Medicaid expansion, you know, putting $1 billion back in the budget for K-12 education, even though they took $1.2 billion out. So he can move back to the middle and start courting with the teachers and the teachers union and health care providers and really people who are some employed, unemployed, or underemployed. So he can move back. So for the governor's chess game he's playing, he's contending he will not have a strong Republican. So move back to the middle now so you don't have to move to the right and then back to the middle in the general.
I want to come back to that idea of centrism, but Lufra, I just want to ask you, President Obama showing he's prepared to reach out and make some concessions on entitlement reform. How do you see that playing out in Florida particularly?
Let's see. L-E-G-A-C-Y, maybe. what you're seeing is Obama searching for a way to leave a legacy that is an important one in his mind. He is a lame duck president right now. He isn't, whatever he does isn't going to impact his election, and frankly, he doesn't care that much about a lot of the Democrats running this time. He's had as much problem with them as some of the Republicans. So you see a president going through a metamorphosis, if you will, and I think it was a courageous step to take. I think it was a necessary step to take, and it's a question now of how much he's willing to bet his political capital that's left, how much is he willing to put that on the table and see where it takes him. And, you know, I think a lot of people are shaking their heads saying, is this another one of his games or that? I hope not. I really hope not, because we certainly need to do some things in that area.
Dick Batchelor, President Obama, is he a lame duck president, do you think?
I don't think he's a lame duck president, but I think he's really trying to move to the middle. He's almost doing what what Clinton did in 94, but really did more aggressively in 96 because the Congress was taken over by Newt Gingrich in 94 and the Republicans. So I think he's moving, but he's making an overture on Social Security and Medicare. In the state of Florida, obviously, with a large senior population, retired population, it does make a difference. Even when you start talking about, you know, way that you calculate the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, as regards automatic increases of Social Security and Medicare, it's tough. But to this point, and I agree with Lou, he's got to do something. He's got to make some overtures. He'll offend some people on the far left because he's making concessions too early on, they think. But he's got to make them. We've got a debt crisis here, and we're going to keep dealing with it. We're going to see the cliff again. We're going to see things like that. So he's got to deal with it.
Let me go back to that point you were making too before about Governor Scott and his kind of move to the center. The point came up that he doesn't have to worry about strong Republican challengers. But I want to ask you, Pam Bondi has been making a number of appearances recently, obviously talking about things to do with her role as Attorney General. And one question she was asked a couple of weeks back in Orlando was, would you consider putting your name in the hat for Lieutenant Governor, for example? And do you see her as a potential candidate for governor?
I see all three of them.
Right.
All three of the
timing. It's all a matter of timing.
If he didn't have the money he had, that you'd have a lot more interest. But if somebody could write a check for $100 million to start the campaign, you're not going to really go. Besides, Scott has changed the way he's campaigned. He's campaigning now like a governor. He's got staff now that really knows what they're doing. He's still under 40% in his popularity, but that's a pretty strong 40%. And I don't see anybody throwing themselves on the sword and wrecking their career. Because they're in a great position to run when he's done. It'll be one of the three who'll probably be the governor candidate for the Republican Party. So why, you know, commit suicide right now? Let somebody else do it.
So you're talking about Pam Bondi, Adam Putnam, and
Jeff Atwater, CFO.
Yes, those three are the prime ones.
They're all chomping at the bit. They're all in the cabinet position to run for governor. It's about timing. One of the things that I don't know the answer to, obviously, is that, is the governor really prepared to spend $78 million of his personal money again? You know, you look at it, maybe I'm too close to it, but you look at it, so I was governor one time, I spent $78 million of my personal money to become governor, and am I prepared to spend $78 million? Now, having said that, he's also raising money to date that he had not raised before. He's raised about $5.5 million already, and he can raise the money because he's the incumbent governor, so he can raise more money this time than he did last time, which means he might not have to write a check for $78 million. But
$77 million.
Oh, yeah, interest.
Yeah.
Interest on it. But it'd be interesting. I don't know the answer to that question, but it's got to be a conversation in the household.
Well, let's talk about Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll stepping down recently in the wake of the Allied Veterans sweepstakes scandal. I mean, what sort of damage, if at all, do you think this does to Scott's administration?
I think very little, because he got out clean. He didn't hide this problem for a period of time. As soon as he found about it, it was out the door. Most people still don't know who Jennifer Carroll is. I mean, it's the same for any lieutenant governor, not just particularly her. And he handled it the proper way. And also, there's a lot of time between now and the election. If it happened the week before or 2 weeks before, total different ballgame. But she's history. She's done fair, not fair. It's unfortunate you're guilty in something like this before you're proven innocent.
And she sees a life for herself in public office down the track, though. I think she hinted as much in a interview. Do you think she does have some kind of political future?
Well, I think it is, let's put it this way, it is very difficult to survive something like this. And the press, it'll be her name, who had to resign under pressure, And it's very difficult to do. And I understand that. I've dealt with a lot of people and friends who've been in that kind of situation. But once you get one of the second fry rules of politics, you got to explain in trouble. Every time she comes up, she gets a debate, she has a meeting or so forth, the question will come up, and it just kills you after a period of time.
Dick Batchel, what do you think? Does this do any sort of damage at all to
And it's a bad pun for me to say, if we were talking about video car arcades, that I wouldn't bet on it. She shouldn't bet on the future in politics. The fact is, she is innocent until proven guilty. But when the FDLE was investigating her and went to the governor, and I agree the governor did the right thing, it was really a crisis in the making, and he unmade it, if I might use that terminology, as opposed to having to carry her along during the campaign. That would have hurt him, I think. And the beauty he has now, he can go look at the demographics and the psychographics and everything else and say, best candidate? Is it Hispanic, female, Dade County, one on the short list there? Is it Pam Bondi, who's got some statewide recognition and national recognition on her litigation of the Affordable Care Act? So he's got the choice now. He's in a good position now.
And he can
choose.
Shop that person or those people all over the state. He can hit every county just about with saying, hey, your person may be lieutenant governor, you know, and on to the next one.
I can tell you a story about that. Now, I'm sure you could too, having run for governor. But I mean, when I was a young legislator. I was only 32. I was 26 when I elected. I was probably 30 at the time. And Bob Chevin was running. He was the attorney general, very popular, going to run for governor because he was running against Bob Graham, a state senator at the time. And my name was on the short list. He was very good at putting people's name on the short list from different geographic areas. Your guy is under consideration to be my lieutenant governor and running mate. So, but the advantage that the governor has, he is going to choose a lieutenant governor, but he can really, I'm going to call it focus group. This be just down and dirty political, what's good politically. Who would sell? Who do I need on my ticket to make me look better than I do today?
When do you see him filling this appointment?
If I was the governor, I'd take as long as I could. I'd go around and talk to every county and mention my good friend Dick Batcher, who would be a great lieutenant governor, and look at what he's done for the state and so forth. And by the way, he's helping me. No, it's a wonderful setup.
Well, let's talk a little more local now. I mean, there's a bill making its way through the legislature that aims to change the way the Expressway Authority is run. And in this change, Mayor Buddy Dyer may lose his seat at the table. Dick Batchel, what impact do you think this might have on the city or on Mayor Dyer himself?
I hope the resolve, and I know Senator Simmons is sponsoring the overall omnibus bill dealing with bringing the Tri-County, I guess it's the Tri-County and Quad County, together on transportation authority. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make any sense to leave out the mayor of the largest city in the region, who took the lead on SunRail. He's taken the lead on Lynx. He's taken the lead as a member of the Lynx board and the Expressway Authority board on all transportation issues. So to me, it would be like a lot of poke of the eye. I mean, bottom line is, take the mayor of Orlando off and put on the mayor of Podunk. It doesn't make sense to me.
What do you see as arising out of this bill, Lou?
possibly Buddy Dyer just changing his mind and deciding maybe he ought to run for governor. You never know. I thought he was in a good spot to run. We've never had a governor elected from Central Florida, mm-hmm. and he certainly had a good base about Orlando, and I think took a lot of people, frankly, by surprise when he decided not to run. And, of course, by the way, when you give that up, then you give up a little of your bargaining chip. So if you get taken off a board or something, it isn't quite the shock it would be if it was a potential governor getting taken off the docket.
Does he have time to change his mind again, do you think?
Yeah, if he could have time. If he could get Charlie out of the race and get Charlie to back him with John Morgan's money, they'd have somewhat of a nice duo.
I've been speaking to 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for coming into the studio again.
Thank you.
We look forward to coming back if we're asked.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Matthew Petty. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. You can email us to intersection@wmfe.org. Up next, a conversation with film director Chad Hartigan. I'm joined in the studio by Chad Hartigan. Chad is a writer and director, and his film This Is Martin Bonner won the Best of Next Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival. His film is screening now at the Florida Film Festival. Thanks for coming in, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the movie This Is Martin Bonner. Now, the main character gives his name to the title of the movie. He's a 50-year-old who leaves his life behind to start over in Reno. Where did he get the inspiration for a story like that?
The inspiration was my dad. He, at age 55, had to move to a town called Leesburg, Virginia, for a job. And my parents are divorced, so he just went alone. And I was just wondering what he was going to do all day, how he was going to spend his time, and if he was going to try and make new friends, and if he, like, how hard that would be. I mean, I know how hard that is for someone my age, or I did that when I was, you know, 12 and when I was 18, and it was hard then, and I can only imagine it's much harder. So it was me sort of trying to put myself in my dad's shoes. That's how the idea came about.
So how much did it cost you to make this film, This Is Martin Bonner?
It cost about $42,000.
Wow. And I read that you quit your job to make the film. Is that right?
Yeah, because that has to do with that mental state I was talking about. I had this kind of relaxing job in Los Angeles where I predicted how much money movies were going to make at the box office, which was, I mean, it's a totally weird, made-up job, but I had it, and it was really easy and comfortable, and so I wasn't really motivated to leave it. In the back of my mind, I wanted to make this movie, but every day to day, I was like having a good time, hanging out with my friends, and making some money. And so I reached a point where I was like, I gotta change this up, and I quit the job, and I moved to Reno, where I didn't really know anybody except my grandmother and my aunts. And I thought that if I was there, because that's where I wanted to shoot the film, I was like, if I was there and I had nothing to do all day but figure out how to make this movie, then I would actually figure out how to make the movie. And that is the case. Like, within a month of being there, we were on the path to really getting it happen.
So why did you decide to go to Reno to make a movie? That's kind of interesting. I mean, did you think, I want to make a movie, I want to make it in Reno, and I'll figure out what it's about after that? Or was it just like, I have this great idea for a movie, and Reno's the place that it really needs to be shot?
There's a couple of reasons. One of them, I mean, I'm very familiar with Reno because I grew up overseas in Cyprus. My parents were both missionaries, actually, and my mom's from Reno. So every third summer, we would go visit her family there. And so until I was like 12 or 13, I thought all of America was exactly like Reno. And it has like a kind of a magical America quality to me that I find interesting. And so I came up with the idea of the movie, and the movie is about a guy that has to move to a place to start over. And I thought, like, what would be like a terrible place someone would have to go at age 58 to start over? And Reno fits, because it's a tough town. I mean, it's like economically it's terrible, and it's kind of seedy, and there's really nothing there on the surface except like the gambling culture, which is but it's also got a lot of natural beauty to it. It's surrounded by mountains, and so it kind of is a nice mix of visual beauty and urban decay that fit the story. So there's a couple of reasons, and then also I knew that my family there could help us out with a few logistical things.
And so you screened this movie at Sundance. I mean, that's a big deal, right? That's kind of like
the big deal for me. Yeah,
the pinnacle of independent films, really, in terms of festivals.
Yeah, it was a total shock, a big surprise. And to be perfectly honest, I had like a cynical view of Sundance myself. I thought that you needed to have movie stars or some kind of connections to get in. But it's still, I mean, you still submit, you know, because you hope and you dream. And then when we got in, it was unbelievable. And then the whole experience was unbelievable. And I was dead wrong about Sundance. And now that I know all the staff there, and they are just the most pure movie lovers. And they love, like, finding a movie that no one has heard of and no one has told them to see. They just, like, pick it out of a pile. Like, that's what they live for, is, like, finding that thing that they can, you know, say that they found. So it was great, and I love that festival now. I love everyone involved, and I had a great time.
So do you find it difficult to relate to a character, you know, fictional or not, who's 20 years older than yourself?
Yeah, it was really difficult. And actually the breakthrough that I had, and I think that the movie has been received well because I had this breakthrough, where at first I was looking at that story as kind of depressing. You know, I was like thinking about my dad being alone and watching TV or reading a book, and I was like, so depressing. And I talked to my friend Aaron, whose dad also lives alone, and he was like, yeah, all my dad does is like watch Antique Roadshow and go to the supermarket. It's really depressing. But if you actually talk to them, they're like, no, I mean, I have lots to do. I read this book. It was great. It's not depressing to them. It's their life. They've lived long enough to know what they like and what they don't like, and they can figure it out. So I just needed to make sure that I made the movie without my young person's condescending perspective on it. I really had to take the perspective of the character. And so hopefully if you watch the movie, you can't tell what I personally think of the situation, because I've totally removed my feeling of it being kind of depressing. So that was really difficult, but that was an important realization that I made early on, and tried to follow through on the whole movie.
And you said in some ways you used your father as kind of like a template or some kind of inspiration for the movie. Did you talk to him about it? Did you say, look, I need some ideas, or you know, this movie sort of takes on some aspects of things that I've observed in you? How did you go about that?
I did talk to him about it, but not on sort of like the deep emotional kind of level that you're talking about. I told him that I was basing a movie on a character that was doing the work he was doing, and that is true. So in the movie and in real life, the character and my dad both worked. They moved for a job working in prison rehabilitation. So I asked him a lot about that, and he would tell me about that. But I never really asked him things like, how does it feel to be alone, you know? That sounds awkward to me. Like, not that I don't have a good relationship with my dad or anything, but I didn't want him to feel like I was making a movie specifically about him, because I wasn't. I was just making a movie about a character in his circumstances. So I only really asked him stuff that was logistical, like, what exactly do you do at work? That kind of stuff.
And when you said about trying to find these actors, did you say, we want somebody, we're looking for an Irish actor or an Australian actor or somebody who's not from the States? How did that work?
In the breakdown, I wrote authentic European.
Okay.
And Paul came anyways. So, and lots of Americans came too. I mean, it's shocking when you put an ad, you could put an ad up on the actors boards and it'd be like, must be over 300 pounds African American, and you would get like a 150 pound Asian person show up. They just either they don't read it or they think they can change your minds. So, but I'm glad Paul did come. I'm glad he did disregard it. And actually, he lived in Seattle at the time and didn't have a lot of money, but he saw that breakdown and somehow it was nothing. You know, it probably just said Martin Bonner, 50s, authentic European, like, nice guy, quiet, whatever the breakdown said. But something about it, he felt like he needed to go to that audition. So he got himself a plane ticket and came to L.A. and auditioned for the movie, which he says he's never done. And it really worked out for the both of us. So that's kind of a strange story of kismet.
Wow. So the must have felt a little bit like you were sort of making something that was going beyond the fictional realm.
Yeah, I did. I felt like there were a number of things that happened that felt like the movie was being pushed towards existence by an outside force. Because like when you're trying to put it together, there's a lot of doubt. You know, you're trying to raise this money, and then you get a tiny bit of money, and they're like, "Well, is that enough? Should we wait for more money?" There's all this doubt. Like, is it time to go? Is it the right time? Should we do this? Should we do that? But there are like three or four things that happened along the way that really felt like, okay, yeah, we need to keep going because like it's something is pushing us towards making this happen. Something bigger is afoot. So, and that was one of the things.
So you've gone from, with this movie, this is Martin Bonney, you've gone from Sundance to the Florida Film Festival here in Orlando.
Yes.
Why Florida after Sundance?
To be honest, I have a lot of friends that have made movies in the past and that were made way more successful than my movie, Luke and Bree Are on a First Date, was. So they had done the whole festival circuit multiple times. And so I just asked them, I was like, what festivals are cool? What festivals should I be applying to? And one of them was Florida, so that's why I submitted. And then you never know if you're going to get in. I mean, even after Sundance, you know, we still get rejected from festivals. So you really never know. But this is my first time here, Florida, and it's been fun so far.
What do you know about the film industry in Florida? I mean, does this seem like a place where there could be some kind of burgeoning film industry?
Yeah, and actually, I think FSU has a really great film program, and the producer of my film and the editor of my film both went to FSU, and I met them at the South by Southwest Film Festival when they were there with a film called The Myth of the American Sleepover, and that was all made by Florida students, and I have a friend named Barry Jenkins who came out of Florida and made a film called Medicine for Melancholy that was great. Amy Simons made a film called Sun Don't Shine. She shot it here, and it was great. So I think that school is producing a lot of good talent. I don't know, not all of them are sticking around and making the films here, but they're making a name for Florida outside of the state, and that can only help the production in the state too.
So what's next for you? Are you looking for a job that's at the moment that's not in film so you can support your next project, or what do you do now?
No, I'm trying to not have to do that. I would love to not have to work at Starbucks or something. So I'm trying to get another film going. I'm writing one, close to being done with a draft. It's still going to take a while to get it to be in a good spot. I'll try and get it done. I don't know. You know, I'll try and get investors interested, and hopefully they'll be, impressed by the Sundance success. I don't know if they will be or not, but, I'll try that, or I'll try and get some grants. Grants are still a nice way to get some funding in the indie film world. But yeah, I anticipate it's not going to be easy. But that's the goal, is to try and get this movie going.
I've been speaking to Chad Hartigan. Chad is a writer and director, and his film This Is Martin Bonner won the Best of Next Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival. His film is screening at the Florida Film Festival. Thanks for coming in, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.